an unusual time for us, but we are glad this all worked out. We will hear now arguments in the case of Empress Casino Joliet Corporation against the Balmoral Racing Club, etc. Mr. McKenna.
May it please the court. William McKenna, on behalf of the defendants and the appellants Maywood and Balmoral. This case really comes down to 90 seconds in a stairwell at Maywood Park when John Johnson was extorted by former Governor Rod Blagojevich through his agent, Lon Monk, for a campaign contribution in return for his signature on a bill. Now, the jury below found, we think erroneously, based on speculation and trial error, that there was, in such, in fact, an agreement reached in that 90 seconds in the stairwell to exchange a contribution or a signature on this bill.
Well, I can certainly understand why you would like to boil it down to that 90 seconds, but there was quite a lead-up to it that the jury heard about, conversations for months about exchanging the signature for money. And I guess, you know, you need to assure me that you're not just re-arguing materials that the jury has already resolved against you.
No, Your Honor. And even taking it the most favorable you can to the jury's decision, what my point is going to be, the initial issue before this court, is really, is that 90 seconds and those events Your Honor just mentioned leading up to the 90 seconds, are they sufficient to sustain a $77 million RICO jury verdict? And the point here, Your Honor, is that the only RICO claim that went to the jury was a 1962D conspiracy claim. And what this panel said in what I'll refer to as Empress 3, which was the court's opinion, most recent opinion on this matter.
Empress N.
Yes. Yes. But what the court said in Empress 3 is for the plaintiffs to prevail on the 1962D theory, they had to prove two things. They had to prove that the defendants agreed to participate in an enterprise through a pattern of racketeering, and that a defendant had to agree to the commission of two predicate acts by someone, not necessarily by the defendant itself. And the panel in that decision cited Roger Whitmore Towing and Brower for that proposition. And in both of those cases, the language of the court is identical. And specifically, it says you must agree to participate in the affairs of an enterprise through a pattern of racketeering. Now, and that means knowingly facilitate that pattern of racketeering. So the court said in the Neapolitan case, a defendant who did not agree to the commission of crimes constituting a pattern of racketeering activity is not in violation of 1962D. Similarly, there's this court's decision in Gorin. There the court said you have to participate in the pattern. You have to agree to participate in the pattern of racketeering, not just a single transaction with the enterprise.
So there's some characterization that's necessary here, of course. I mean, we've got all kinds of opinions, both pretrial and things about instructions from the district court. One of the predicate acts, one of the types of predicate acts, I'll say, that's possible under RICO is wire fraud. And the district court judge thought that there was a pattern of wire fraud going on here, that it wasn't just the agreement to pay the $100,000, which certainly as a agreement to pay a bribe is a different kind of predicate act. Different people are involved as well with these different phone calls and in some instances arrangements for the bribes. So why doesn't that constitute a pattern? Why couldn't the jury have found that constituted a pattern?
Okay, so Your Honor, first of all, the important thing that I think is going on here and went on at the trial is you have this Blagojevich enterprise, you know, which is brought to the fore involving Mr. Blagojevich and some of his aides and their dastardly activities, selling seats on boards and commissions, and
no, we're very familiar.
Extorting with money, yes, Your Honor, extorting money from Children's Hospital, etc. It is absolutely undisputed on this record that Mr. Johnston had no involvement in any of that, and had no knowledge of any of that. And the same is true for Maywood and Balmoral. They just flatly weren't involved in those activities. So the only activities of this enterprise that there's any evidence of involvement with is the 90 seconds in the stairwell and the events leading up to that. So the first question is, can that ever be a pattern? Now, and the second question is, are there two predicate acts there?
Well, when you have a conspiracy case, explain to me some more why the decision to commit acts in conjunction with the Blagojevich enterprise isn't something that, if it was clear how business was done with the Blagojevich enterprise, that your clients can share some liability for.
Well, because, Your Honor, the touchstone of the 1962 D claim is agreement to participate in the pattern of racketeering. And it's these other deeds that my client had nothing to do with, which is what they used to get to the pattern. If all you look at is the 90 seconds in the stairwell and the events leading up to that, you really don't have a pattern. It's short term. It's at most 8 months. We would say it's even less.
You argued all this to the jury, didn't you? That it was 90 seconds in the stairwell.
We absolutely did, Your Honor.
They didn't buy it. I'm forgetting the exact dates, but April, over the course of the summer, it was a long time leading up to that end of November set of events.
Right, but I'm talking about the legal requirements that this court has imposed for finding a pattern of racketeering. I'm not talking about what the jury found. And they're just not there, Your Honor.
So you don't think wire fraud here can be a predicate act?
It can be a predicate act, but I don't see it, Your Honor. If you want to turn to the question of predicate acts and the two predicate acts that my client needs to have agreed to in order for there to be a 1962D liability, okay, I understand the 90 seconds in the stairwell and the bribery and the quid pro quo. I don't agree with it, but I understand it. But then when you leave that, what do you have? Well, you have phone calls, which is what the district court suggested. But if you look at each and every one of those phone calls, in every phone call, first of all, Mr. Johnston and Mr. Monk, who are the only two people who testified at trial who were actually involved in this situation, both said the tie, that is the quid pro quo. The only thing that under McCormick would make this thing unlawful didn't occur until December the 3rd. So all these phone calls that you have that predate the 90 seconds in the stairwell and begin in April of 2008 are phone calls in which Mr. Johnston is asked for a contribution. He testified and Mr. Monk confirmed there were five or six calls on which Mr. Monk said, well, when are you going to get your money in? When are you going to give some money?
One of them, at least, Johnston's more or less saying, and yeah, I'm going to do it. He says, I'm good for it. I'm just figuring out which accounts to pull the checks from.
Your Honor, Mr. Johnston didn't say those things. Those were all wiretape conversations between Mr. Blagojevich and Mr. Monk. And that's Mr. Monk who agreed on the stand that he lied frequently in these tapes, telling his master, Mr. Blagojevich.
I don't remember the record this way, that it's not Johnston who says, I'm good for it, it is, I'm just figuring out which accounts to
Your
pull
Honor,
the
it
check.
Is not Johnston who says that. That is Monk
it
on a
It makes no
recorded,
sense for Monk. He wasn't going to be the payor.
I understand, but it's Monk purporting to quote Johnston to Blagojevich on a tape.
Okay, so
and
that's
Mr. Johnston had no knowledge
point.
Of
so
those tapes.
So a co-conspirator hearsay. So Johnston, the jury could have thought Johnston said that.
Well, the jury could have drawn an inference, but, Your Honor, the problem is saying you're good for it is about a contribution. There's no tie. There is no nexus at that point between a request for a political contribution and an official act. Take the April 2008 meeting, which was the subject of testimony at trial between Mr. Johnston and Mr. Blagojevich. At that meeting, Mr. Johnston makes a presentation about the legislative agenda for the next year, talks about slots on track, talks about possible renewal of the 3% bill. Mr. Blagojevich is noncommittal, says, I hear you, okay, great, and then says, I appreciated your support in the past, I would like to see some support in the future.
And your opponents suggest that meeting took place at the Friends of Blagojevich headquarters, that there was a lot of context to it, that it was quite clear it wasn't just a regular old political contribution which would have been okay, that anybody was talking about, and that they also suggest that the wiretaps show that Johnston is talking about the money in exchange for the signature.
There's no wiretaps that predate December the 3rd in which Johnston's talking about money in exchange for a signature. It is correct that this was a meeting at Friends of Blagojevich and not at some government office, but Mr. Blagojevich was known to do a lot of business at Friends of Blagojevich. And really the problem, Your Honor, is the McCormick case. The Supreme Court of McCormick said you have to have an explicit promise or undertaking to get to a quid pro quo.
But they don't mean that. The Supreme Court has never ruled out circumstantial evidence in these cases.
I certainly agree, Your Honor. But Your Honor, on the other hand, while the Supreme Court has never ruled out circumstantial evidence, what you have here is a paradigm of what every politician does when they receive a contributor for a meeting to discuss about legislative needs. The legislative issues are discussed and vetted back and forth, and the politician may conclude the meeting by saying, "I've appreciated your support in the past and look forward to it in the future." If that, Your Honor, is a quid pro quo or sufficient evidence for a quid pro quo, RICO is vastly expanded.
No, the jury was told that there could be legitimate political contributions, but the jury's also told that there could be money in exchange for an official act, and the latter is certainly a violation of the law. And so I'm not sure whether you're attacking the jury instructions here, but the jury finds that the money is for the political act of signing the bill.
No, I'm saying where's the second predicate act? And I'm saying that meeting in and of itself has no quid pro quo.
So you concede that the first one is a predicate act?
I don't concede, Your Honor, that there was an agreement in the stairwell. I don't think there was sufficient evidence given the testimony of Monk and Johnston, but I can understand where the meeting in the stairwell could be argued to be a predicate act. I'm saying where's the second one? And I look at the First Circuit's decision in Roeder and this circuit's decision in Roger Whitmore, where the court says, look, a single bribe that involves communications, talking back and forth, and some steps, some mailings, some emails, that cannot create a pattern. And you have to agree to a pattern of racketeering activity. It didn't happen here because of that.
Well, we have the distinction between two schemes, which we know we don't need to have.
Correct.
And two or more, of course, predicate acts. And as I understand the district court's theory, it's certainly the case that this is not a two-scheme situation. It's the one. But then the question is, how much do you break it down? Because there are a number of different actions taken that look like they independently violate the law, so they could be several predicate acts. District court has like a little list at one point.
Well, like I was saying, Your Honor, if Your Honor looks at the Morgan standards for determining a pattern of racketeering, which the court still
looks... That's a closed end, right? Isn't Morgan's...
Pardon me?
I thought Morgan dealt with a different kind of...
Well, Morgan deals with closed-ended continuity.
Right, it's closed-end, not
open. But if you look at those standards, the stairwell backward through the events leading up to it simply don't meet any of those standards. It's short-term, few victims, single scheme, few predicate acts. And if you look at open-ended, where's the repetition? As this court observed in United States versus Blagojevich, by the time of this incident, Mr. Blagojevich had already decided not to run for a third term. He was a lame duck. The kind of statutory alleged quid pro quo that occurred here could never have reoccurred because the statute wasn't going to sunset until 2011. There's essentially no risk. Additionally, on open-ended continuity, Your Honor, there's been some suggestion in the briefs by the casinos that open-ended continuity could be satisfied because there's repeated injuries by reason of the daily payment of the taxes. But this court's decisions in Vicom, for example, clearly state that if it's one injury that is then shared out over time, which is what happened here, there's one statute, 3% of their gross revenue paid each day over that next time period. Now, Your Honor, I'd also like to speak briefly about what we think are the trial errors, and I'd like to start with the admission into evidence of the entire history of contributions to Mr. Berlage.
Mr. McKenna, before you get into those, I'd like to just raise with you a more general question, and if you want to answer this on rebuttal, I certainly understand that. But if we were to agree with you on the RICO pattern problem, but disagree with you on the other issues you've raised, would there be any obstacle to us simply ordering an amendment of the judgment to remove the RICO trebling and allow the rest of the judgment to stand under the state law theories?
Well, we still have our argument, Your Honor, that the state law theories were improperly allowed.
I understand.
Your Honor.
I've read it.
Yes, Your Honor.
I haven't seen us reverse district judges for allowing amendments. So if we disagree with you on the other issues and agree with you on the RICO pattern problem,
right,
would there be any obstacle that would avoid a substantive remand? Or could we just order, take out the trebling?
Well, that would also need to ignore the damages argument we raised. But if the court were to do that, yes.
That is what I'm asking you
yes,
to assume.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes. That could be done, and that would eliminate the trebling. But we would think that would be erroneous because we don't think the damages were correct either. Now, going to the trial error and the admission into evidence of the entire history of contributions, as this panel knows very well, in the Empress III decision, the court rejected the theory that campaign contributions can be disguised bribes.
Well, we actually found that the prior contribution evidence wasn't sufficient to support the casino's claim. We didn't really find that the prior contributions were lawful.
I agree with that, Your Honor. But the court did find that the mere proximity without more, and I think I'm quoting the language of the panel opinion correctly, is not sufficient to raise a quid pro quo that could go to a jury.
Well, in other words, you know, you needed that more. But the thing is, the district court's instructions said that. We don't micromanage instructions. The district court said that it's not unlawful to make political contributions, and this was part of, you know, history and context is what the court lets this in for. And this was discussed in the jury instruction conference. I'm not sure that there's anything else that you had any right to have.
The district court
didn't instruct them that because somebody had made, you know, a $3,000 contribution to Rod Blagojevich at some point along the way, they had violated any law.
Right. Well, 2 points, Your Honor. The first is the jury instruction did not tell the jury that these particular contributions were legal.
But he says, you know, he signals to the jury political contributions are not unlawful.
But second, Your Honor, this was really all about propensity. And this court said in the Simplex case, in dealing with habit.
But we're not under 404. Your whole theory is that these contributions are legal. They're not prior bad acts.
Right, but Your Honor, in our motion in limine number 3, we specifically argued rule 404 because their basis for admission was regular practice. We had a regular practice
That's
of making these donations.
If it's anything, and I don't think that it's either one of them. I think it was just part of the history and background so that somebody could see how this $100,000 compared to the $3,000 or $4,000 a pop that was happening.
Well, I would leave the point, Your Honor, by saying that you also have to look at what was said to the jury about this history of contributions. Heavily argued in closing, the full amount, the contrast with what was given to earlier governors, and in the direct examination of Mr. William Johnston, John Johnston's father, counsel specifically asked the question, isn't it true that you gave 50 times more to Blagojevich than you gave to any other governor ever? And after the witness answered yes, counsel then said, and I quote, Mr. Blagojevich, I guess, was different than other candidates. It's a pure propensity play. They're trying to suggest you're involved with Blagojevich, Blagojevich was bad, therefore there must be something here. And
Mr. McKenna, is it correct that the district judge had initially agreed with you to keep that evidence out?
He initially agreed only to keep out contributions to former Governor Edgar, and then he, we think again wrongly, determined that we opened the door, not by talking about it, but by simply Mr. Johnston testifying to the general budget that the TRAC had for political contributions and how it was used in general election years versus other years.
Well, I'll just say that does sound to me like one could reasonably say that's opening the door to the details. Why was that an abuse of discretion? Because those are the very, very hard to pin down judgments a trial judge has to make.
Well, I agree, Your Honor, that those are judgments the trial judge has to make, but in this case it was a judgment that was made that really allowed a truck to be driven through and the jury to be banged over the head with the whole Blagojevich thing. And Mr. Johnston really didn't make any reference to Mr. Edgar or what he contributed to Mr. Edgar in the past. I did want to very briefly, before I'm already into my rebuttal time, talk about the adverse inference here, because the adverse inference is another real problem for us in this case. I mean, the judge did specifically instruct the jury that in a civil case like this one, you may conclude that Mr. Johnston had information that would have incriminated him. And the problem, Your Honors, is that Mr. Johnston never refused to answer a single question.
Well, you may conclude. I mean, you guys went back and forth on how many times the word may had to appear in this sentence, but the judge, anytime there's a Fifth Amendment issue, the person might have evidence that tends to incriminate them, might not, might be quiet because of that. And I think the judge is just saying it was a permissible inference, although not a necessary one.
He did say that. But the problem with what he did, Your Honor, was he didn't exercise any standards. He didn't put any judgment into his determination.
What do you think he should have said?
Here's what he should have done. He should have done exactly what the court did in the Doe case in the Ninth Circuit. There, the Fifth Amendment was invoked, but then on one issue, and the individual testified on all others. And the court there said, we have to weigh. We have to actually do the least harm to the party invoking the Fifth that we can while protecting the party against whom it was invoked. So if there's a gap of information, if there's some information that's not available because of the invocation of the Fifth, the inference would be proper. But if there's no gap of information, if every bit of evidence was testified to, there should be no inference. And that's highly prejudicial.
Well, an alternative interpretation is, I needed time to get my story straight, right? So I'm not going to answer any questions today. But years later, when I'm having my deposition taken in the civil case and after I've gotten completely lawyered up, now I've got my story straight, I can stick to it. Why isn't it reasonable to allow that inference based on the invocation of the Fifth years earlier?
Because you're doing...
On the same subjects.
Certainly, Your Honor. All you're doing is punishing the defendants here and Mr. Johnston for the invocation of the Fifth Amendment, and you're not remedying lack of information.
The Fifth Amendment is intended to protect him in criminal...
That's right.
From criminal liability. It's not a license to deceive in the civil context.
I agree, Your Honor, and I agree that that's the purpose for allowing a judge to invoke this inference in front of a jury. But the problem is, if there's no information that the other side was stopped from getting, if every question ever asked, grand jury, two criminal trials, one deposition, and trial on the merits here, was answered...
But you don't have to believe all the answers. I mean, you know, there's... Yes, I mean, he certainly testifies, but this is additional information going, at a minimum, to his credibility and to other points.
They could have argued credibility. We didn't object to the admission into evidence of the immunity agreement. What we objected to was telling the jury that they could draw this inference against my client. Well, I'm going to, if I can, unless the court has further questions, I'll reserve a little time for my rebuttal.
That would be fine. Mr. Andelman.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Thank you for accommodating the schedule this afternoon.
So, Mr. Andelman, would you start for us with the subject of what you think your best case is on what the second predicate act is here? It's easy enough to see that the agreement to form the bribe in exchange for the signature is a predicate act. That's one of those things RICO covers. But why do all the phone calls just arranging that bribe count separately? And if they don't, what's the other predicate act?
I can answer that in two ways. I could start with the phone calls, or I could go chronologically. We think that the first clear evidence of a predicate act in this case was that April meeting at Friends of Blagojevich, because Mr. Johnson testified his antenna went up when he heard that's where he was meeting. He knew they were talking about both legislation and giving money in the same conversation. He said he knew.
But it's all for the same thing that we wind up with at the end of November. I'm trying to figure out. I mean, obviously, you could break things down into, you know, waking up in the morning and having breakfast every day too. But it seems that that's not a meaningful distinction. So why do all these meetings and phone calls leading up to and organizing, so to speak, the planned bribe, and I guess it actually never even takes place because Blagojevich gets arrested and everything else happens, but why do we chop it up that finely, and is that what RICO is really all about?
Well, I would say that first meeting was an act of official misconduct. I don't know if they reached an agreement there, but I think with regard to the wires...
Explain what you mean by that.
Well, in that context, he goes to talk about legislation and money comes up at the same time, and he kind of knows that's what's going to happen. He's
so
participating
in
Rod.
Other than the casino tax, I guess I'll call it.
Yeah, he was going to talk about the act and money at the same time. He knew that was inappropriate, and Blagojevich, in that context, was engaged in an act of official misconduct. When we get to then there's a phone call in September or August. There was some ambiguity about the evidence, where Rod Blagojevich calls Johnston, and it has to be viewed as a follow up to that meeting. It's the next time they speak. And that's when he gets the commitment from Johnston to pay the $100,000. And that is a use of the wires.
And you see that as an independently unlawful act of wire fraud?
It is, because under this court's case law, going back to the Witherspoon case in the 70s, the court recognized that with wire fraud, it's not the underlying fraud that's the crime, it's the use of the wires to advance the scheme. And so in that instance, he's on the telephone with Rob Blagojevich. The crime is the use of the wires to advance the scheme.
And so you put the bribe as the scheme and all of these other independent things as independent criminal violations.
Yeah, and there are, I would say there are many cases where the use of the wires is recognized. It's separately indictable under 1961.5, which is defining the racketeering acts. Any separately indictable conduct is an act of racketeering. And each use of the wires to advance the scheme is a racketeering act. And then we also have on the back end that a intention of this scheme is that there's going to be a series of wires going into the future, not from one person, but from four different companies, each one a divisible injury, an amount of money that they're wiring every day. So an inherent aspect of this scheme is that there is going to be a repeated use of wires to send money from my clients to Mr. Johnson and others through this trust fund.
So if I sell somebody a phony bond over... And I defraud them once, and then payments are delivered over, you know, let's say every 6 months or every 3 months, over a period of 10 years. Those are all separately chargeable acts of wire fraud.
I think if part of the scheme initially in here, there was always foreseeable that there were going to be these wires, it could be. I mean, there's, and the case law, what the cases say on this is that it is very fact specific.
Yeah, I think you're generally correct that the federal courts, including this one, have been pretty lax in terms of the ability of prosecutors to slice and dice these schemes into many multiple chargeable offenses. But the big problem I have here is with the concept of the pattern.
The way I look at this, Judge Hamilton, is you have multiple uses of the wires, both the telephone calls leading up to December of 2008, the wires afterwards. There is certainly more than two indictable acts of racketeering that the jury heard evidence about. And then you couple that with the fact that this is an open-ended scheme. And so what
so is your best evidence on that the fact that it was going to sunset in 2011, or is your best evidence of that, did you stress to the jury, it's open-ended because you keep paying this 3% tax out into the indefinite future?
What I argued to the jury was that this was going to come up for renewal. They saw an exhibit, I think it was Trial Exhibit 16, that was an email where Mr. Johnston and others were already discussing in 2008, we have to make sure that in 2011 this gets renewed. So this was something that they were thinking about. They had agreed to participate with Blagojevich in this way.
Why was the Blagojevich enterprise going to have anything to do with the renewal?
Well, I mean, this statement that Mr. McKenna made about Blagojevich being a lame duck, there was zero evidence of that at this trial. There's no reason that I know of. Maybe there was something that came into the Blagojevich trial, but there was no reason that I knew of and nothing that this jury heard to suggest that he was going to be a lame duck or he wasn't going to be governor in 2011.
No, I mean, obviously, Illinois had some long-term governors, like Jim Thompson, for example, mm-hmm. so there's no two-term limit or anything here. But on the other hand, by December of 2008, the handwriting was on the wall for Governor Blagojevich.
Well, I mean, you know, people escape from all kinds of briar patches, and so I don't think that there was there certainly wasn't any evidence to suggest that Mr. Johnston thought that Blagojevich wasn't going to be around in 2011. And what you did have was emails talking about the fact that they were thinking about the renewal of this act and how to deal with that issue as early as 2008.
Well, just in terms of deciding how to draft the bill, right?
No, this was in the context of their lobbying efforts.
Yeah, sure, but you're going to have to come back. It's like a lot of legislation.
What they were actually saying is we need to be on top of this next time because they got caught short in 2008. The bill actually expired in May, and they had this gap when there was no bill. And they were saying we need to get our ducks in a row earlier in 2011 so that we don't have this issue again where the bill lapses. You know, what
on the other hand, they might have been blessed with an honest governor in 2011.
Could have happened. It could have. And they could have argued that to the jury. Mm-hmm. I mean, look, the judge would ask the question to Mr. McKenna, I can't tell if you're disputing the jury instructions, but they're not. So this is a situation where the jury, including with regard to the pattern requirements, was given an undisputed instruction. There's no question that the jury had the proper law. So this is really a sufficiency of the evidence appeal. Jury could have reached the conclusion.
Counsel, we have a number of cases from around the country dealing with similar, at least broadly similar questions about applying civil RICO to bribery schemes. What case of those best supports your contention that there's a pattern here?
I mean, I think we talked about it maybe when we were in Empress III. We had that Beter versus Bloomquist case we talked about from the Eighth Circuit. There have been...
That was mainly just about whether you could get... In Empress III, we were talking about whether enactment of legislation was something that you could challenge under civil RICO.
There was
the
a
pattern,
decision.
The pattern is another story. Mm-hmm.
There was a decision. I just this morning before I came over, I had shepherdized HJ Inc. There was a decision last month in the District Court of New Jersey. It's United States versus Ferrero, 2015 WL 773-7341, where they affirm a RICO conviction. It's a criminal case, but they talk about the fact that multiple payments can constitute multiple offenses. It goes to the exact issue we were talking a moment ago.
I mean, look, we've got the First Circuit saying no. We've got HJ with a much longer term repeated scheme with many more bribes being alleged.
I don't know that I would say the First Circuit certainly held no in Roeder. But Roeder went out of its way to say, we reject the notion that a single episode cannot support RICO. In that case, there was no ongoing enterprise. So I know they want to divorce themselves from the enterprise. We obviously argued to the jury that they agreed to participate in the enterprise. In this situation, in our context, we had a sustained ongoing enterprise with which they had agreed to participate. In Roeder is a classic example of what the courts refer to as a run-of-the-mill state law fraud case, commercial bribery, one instance, neither of the defendants or, you know, the bribor or the bribee had ever been involved in anything like that before. It was a one-off. And so what the courts talk about, and Judge Feinerman issued an opinion last week on this in the Northern District of Illinois, and talking about how the continuity requirement is to avoid the misuse of RICO in garden variety commercial disputes. This is not a garden variety commercial dispute. This is a situation where these defendants willingly, the jury found willfully, participated in a criminal enterprise, a corrupt public enterprise. And I think that distinguishes it.
Can you talk about the adverse inference instruction, particularly in light of the fact that Johnston testified?
So my view, Judge Williams, is that his testimony certainly was, they were able to and did argue that that went to the weight of the inference. But the inference, the instruction that was given was a proper one, which is that the inference is permissive. You can either find it or not find it. It actually tracked the language in his immunity agreement that the information he had might incriminate him. They were allowed to find that it would incriminate him. And the way I argued that was, you know, you heard his testimony, because they said, well, he testified truthfully, so you should ignore it. And I said, no, he didn't testify truthfully. And what you heard was him come in and prevaricate. And I gave examples of where I felt like he had not told the truth. And I said, so you combine that with what he told the government. That's the broader picture. I mean, the truth is, at trial, the inference, this isn't a case like Doe or some of these others where there's no corroboration and you're just relying on the inference to get a verdict. This was one piece of many pieces of evidence that this jury had. And so our argument with regard to the invocation, the whole immunity issue, had more to do with the fact that he came in to court the first day he testified and in essence, I think, lied to the jury and said, I gave the government my full and complete testimony before I received immunity. And then the next morning when Judge Kennelly said, you know, if you're going to stick to that, then I'm going to allow the plaintiffs to call your defense lawyer as a rebuttal witness, because we all know that's not how it happens. Then he said, well, all right, his counsel said, well, maybe you can ask him those questions again, you get a different answer, and that's what happened. And so at closing, I said, look, you saw two versions of that. That's the best example you could ask for a jury, because they literally saw him say one thing one day and something else the next. And that's really how this immunity issue played out at trial. Well, we weren't arguing an adverse inference in some kind of isolation. And the instruction was given was proper instruction. It followed the law, and it was appropriate. In fact, I think when we were here last time, Judge Hamilton even said, this is a civil case, so I assume there's going to be an adverse inference instruction. I also want to address this issue about the prior contributions, because they really came in for a very discreet, narrow purpose. And in their briefs, they suggest that we argued that they were proof that he had bribed the governor before. And that's just categorically not what we argued. In the rebuttal, my rebuttal in closing, I specifically said, you know, defense counsel has said they gave contributions before and there's nothing wrong with that, and that's absolutely true unless it's for quid pro quo. And I argued to the jury that that's what they had seen as evidence, that these contributions were for quid pro quo.
Wait, these contributions the 2008, being the more recent ones.
Yeah,
the 2008 ones. And yeah. So I understood the district court to be saying they came in to show kind of what the background level of contributions was until this 2008 activity heats up.
Well, I think they also came in to explain some of the testimony. So there's one of the calls, Johnson's quoted as saying, well, you know I'm okay, I've given these amounts before.
Right. And
actually, one of the ironies of them raising this as an issue on appeal is one of our key pieces of evidence is that when the charges first became publicized against Blagojevich and it was known that there was someone, Racetrack Executive One, who had given $100,000 as a bribe to Blagojevich. That was in the media. And I asked him at his deposition, did you know that was you? And he said, yeah, because no one else had given $100,000, but I knew I had. Mm-hmm. And that came out in the jury. And then at trial, they used the prior contributions And Mr. Johnston actually testified that what he meant by that was he knew he had given $100,000 in 2002 and 2006, and that's why he said that. So they were relying on that evidence, not in a particularly credible way, but it was. But they relied on it. And in their closing, they talked about how he was dropping big, you know, in 2006 and dropping big in other years, and he gave money all the time. So I don't find that to be that issue is kind of a non-issue, because my view is they put their arms around that evidence.
So maybe you can talk a little bit about the theory of damages, because as I understand, the jury wasn't told about their alternative theory that this bill was going to become law by operation of the Illinois Constitution anyway, and so once it became law, the casinos were going to be paying the tax no matter what.
Well, no one was told about that theory of damages. I think the procedural context of that's very important. We moved in limine to keep out all evidence of the 60-day rule and the veto-proof majority evidence. And in the pretrial conference on November 26th, there was discussion of that, and they said, well, we need that to argue there was no proximate cause. And Judge Cannelli said, well, hold on, I'm looking at Empress 3. Empress 3 says it's irrelevant to proximate cause. So then a different defense lawyer got up and said, no, actually what we need it for is motive. We need that to show that he had no motive to pay a bribe because it was going to become a law anyways. And Judge Cannelli heard that argument and then moved on to the next issue. When he issued his opinion, he said he was going to allow it in subject to an instruction that it was only admissible with regard to motive, since that was our issue that they said they were going to use it for. He then did a limiting instruction that was consistent with that prior ruling, that the told the jury they could only consider it for motive. And so then what they're appealing is him sustaining my objection when all of a sudden they wanted to argue that evidence for damages. And I objected, and he sustained it, and he said that's inconsistent with my instructions, it was inconsistent as well with his motion in limine ruling. So it can hardly be an abuse of discretion for him to sustain an objection requiring them to stick to something they said they were going to do, and they're not appealing, by the way, those prior rulings. Substantively, though, it was irrelevant to damages, because this isn't a case where you can parse proximate cause from damages. And that's why I think in the panel's decision in Empress 3, it said damages aren't difficult to calculate in this case, because once Blagojevich signs it, then the full 3% is going to be paid. You can't separate out. It's not like a personal injury case where you can say you caused my loss of my legs, but now I have to prove my damages. How did that impact my life? It's not parsable that way. So it really was irrelevant. The truth is, those are counterfactuals. Whether or not he would have vetoed it or not vetoed it, or the 60-day rule would have come into effect, those things never had an opportunity to happen because he signed the bill. And we argued to the jury he signed the bill because of this unlawful agreement. And the jury agreed. Your Honor, unless you have additional questions, I don't have other issues.
Apparently not. So okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. McKenna.
Let me briefly talk about damages. First of all, the reason it was important to us for our theory to have been heard to the jury is made most evident by the note the jury gave out. It's in the record at transcript at page 1182.
But don't you need to back up and respond to what Mr. Andelman said about the untimeliness of your alerting the district court to the fact that this was your theory of damages and you wanted to present it through the instructions and so on?
Yes, Your Honor. The entire in limine process that Mr. Andelman made reference to was limited to proximate cause. It had nothing to do with damages.
But you have an obligation to tell the judge if you want an instruction.
Your Honor, we then had the jury instruction on damages, and it was basically the pattern instruction. It was basically, you may award damages to the extent it was directly caused. That was what the instruction was. So that wasn't the problem. You know, we had the 60 days. We had multiple witnesses testify that the governor was always going to sign the bill. And then the jury comes out with this note that says, we have concern about accurately calculating damages. We're not certain what total dollar amount we should work with or how to break that down. And that's after we were cut off from arguing. I mean, our argument was basically you have two concurrent causes here. You have the legislature.
I understand your argument. I just am concerned that there is no predicate for the district court to go there.
Your Honor, the evidence was, what I'm trying to say is the evidence was in the record by reason of the testimony about the 60 days and by reason of the testimony that he was always going to sign the bill. Based on whatever evidence is in the record, a party should be free to articulate its damages theory so long as it's consistent with the law. And we have the restatement here that says if you have two concurrent causes and the evidence provides a reasonable basis for the fact finder to determine that any legally culpable conduct was a legal cause of less than the entire damage. And we had specific evidence from a representative of the Illinois Racing Board laying out each day what amount of taxes were paid pursuant to this bill. So we had the entire evidentiary record set in our mind for this argument. We began the argument in closing. Counsel objected. He referenced the proximate cause instruction, and the court sustained the objection and wouldn't permit the argument.
Okay, if you would like to take just 1 minute and
certainly
sum up for us, I'll let you do that.
Well, Your Honor, we would request that the court reverse the verdict entirely and enter judgment in favor of our clients, and in the alternative, order a new trial at which the evidentiary issues that we've complained of are not admitted and in which we are allowed to make our damages argument to the jury. Unless the court has further questions, I appreciate the court's attention.
Okay, thank you very much. The court will take the case under advisement.